You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, one and all, wherever you happen to be, all around this gorgeous planet we call Earth. And a special welcome for all of you who are joining us for the very, very first time tonight. Welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. Rod Beckstrom has resigned. Now, you may be saying, oh, okay, well, who is Rod Beckstrom, right? Well, Rod Beckstrom was the head of the Department of Homeland Security National Cybersecurity Center. As of March the 13th, he resigned. That was the effective date of his resignation. Now, the reason was what was interesting about this. Now, remember, he was head of the Department of Homeland Security National Cybersecurity Center. And the reason that he gave for resigning was, and I quote, NSA dominates most national cyber efforts. And then he went on to explain that the NSA is making some moves to have all cybersecurity brought under the NSA umbrella. And he said that this poses threats to our democratic processes. He said, if we do this, threats to our democratic processes are significant. I present that to you without comment. Just thought you might want to know. A reminder about our Gods in the Garden seminar. It's coming up this Sunday at 3 p.m. Pacific time, West Coast time. So the email that I sent to all of you who are registered, I sent that out yesterday or day before, had a link in there where you can convert to whatever time you're in, whatever time zone you're in. But 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, actually Pacific Daylight Time or whatever, West Coast Time, Los Angeles Time, 3 p.m. Now, the deadline for registering is noon tomorrow. We have to set the deadline at noon tomorrow because by 1 o'clock, I have to be sending out passwords to everyone who has registered. And that brings up, I'm still getting email from several folks who have registered wanting to know where their password is. Well, all along, we've been saying you get your password 2 days before. Okay. So tomorrow, after 12 o'clock noon, we'll send out passwords. But if you're planning on registering, you need to get on with it because, number one, the deadline's at 12 noon. Number two, this is the final run for the Gods in the Garden seminar. Now, you might be saying, oh, wait a minute, this is the first run. No, it's not. It's the first one in the United States. But it's the last time I'll be doing it. If you want to attend live online, then you need to get registered, and you've got until noon tomorrow. Also, the K-Files e-zine is our free weekly newsletter, and it's absolutely free, and there are no strings attached, and this is where we keep people informed about what's going on inside of the Kevin Smith Show, what's coming up, details about things like I've just been discussing. We do that in the K-Files e-zine. It's going out tonight. It has to go out early because of the seminar. So if you haven't subscribed, go to my website and subscribe. When we come back after this break, we're going to be talking with William Alec. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said earlier, my guest this evening is William Alec. And he's quite an interesting individual. I think you're going to discover that. Over 25 years he has spent as an embedded hardware software engineering consultant to such major corporations as Motorola, General Electric, and Bendix, and some others. He's a graduate of the Illinois Institute of Technology. He's an inventor. He's an anti-gravity researcher. And this is his first appearance on our show. We're delighted that he's here. Bill, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Kevin.
Bill, I spent some time looking at various websites today, some of them yours and some of them other people's websites that have featured you either in an article or they've interviewed you or things like that. And it was pretty interesting to discover that you've been active in research and experimentation with something called Over Unity Technology for really quite some time. Tell us a little bit about that. What is Over Unity Technology? I know, but I think maybe it's terminology some folks won't know. So tell us what it is, and why are you interested in that?
Well, I'm extremely fascinated with the technology. I was first introduced to it back in this September of 1998, where I attended a Richard Hoagland conference in Seattle, Washington. And at this conference, Tom Bearden was given a lecture. And I suppose a number of your listeners have heard of Tom Bearden.
Mm-hmm.
And he presented some extremely fascinating information that personally I never heard before. Now, I came out of the academia, you know, industrial side of things here. I got my degree in electrical engineering from the Illinois Institute of Technology back in 79, and pursued just working in industry. Mm-hmm. All these years. You know, and then I attended this conference, and everything changed for me. And Tom Bearden was given this lecture on free energy, and he was talking about anti-gravity, and that's when I just became hooked on this subject, and I had to pursue it further. And then I started building a website, and then collecting information, and just building a huge library, you know, on this this technology, and started doing my own experiments. And it was, you know, quite fascinating. It was quite a journey here. But let's start at the very beginning here. Let's go back to the year 1977. This was when I was a junior in college. I was shown a vision of my future. It was a dream vision, which was just totally shocking. I mean, I was totally shocked when I was shown this vision. And in this vision, I'm in what appears to be a hangar. And in this hangar is a desk. I was working on a desk. And, you know, having the mind of a college student back then, I had no idea, you know, how this thing worked. But yet, here I am working on this machine. And I knew it was going to lift off the ground, you know, as a flying disc. And I was completely shocked by this vision. And the, you know, and it started to all come together when I attended this Tom Bearden conference back in 1998. And then I knew that, you know, this vision was going to manifest into reality. And today I'm starting to grasp, you know, exactly what this technology is, you know, what this anti-gravity technology is, and how it relates to free energy, you know, and over unity. Now, you brought up the topic of over unity, and what that has to do with is something called free energy.
Mm-hmm.
And free energy is something that it's primarily poo-pooed in mainstream science.
Well, most everything that's progressive is.
Yes, yes. Well, free energy, I've been researching it now since, you know, Tom Bearden brought it up back in 98. And I've done a number of experiments, and I think I've actually observed free energy in my experiments. And people, the listeners out there, can go to my website. It's intellect.com, and it's spelled intalek.com. And they can look at you know, all my research in this field.
Well, I tell you, in addition to that, there is also a video at YouTube where you're being interviewed and you're explaining one of your experiments and how it works, and you explain that you've been able to get, I think it was 140% above the baseline charge. And then when you added another lead to it, a second spark, you got something like 170%.
Right. Yeah. This is the carbon arc experiments.
Mm-hmm.
I did this just a few years ago, and it's something that's been around for quite some time, but just not research. It's been, of course, you know, largely ignored by mainstream science. And there were some experiments done, I believe, it was back in the '60s, and then I kind of picked up the ball here and started doing some experiments with these carbon arcs, and I observed excess energy in carbon arcs, which I thought was rather interesting. And I compared it with using other types of metals and observed that, you know, the usual under unity type effects using ordinary metals, but when I switched to a carbon rod, the exact opposite happened. I started observing excess energy from this experiment.
So now, is that what you would term as free energy?
Well, the experiment was picked up with back around, I think it was 2002, 2003, somewhere around that time frame, a researcher by the name of Jean-Louis Naudin. He's a French researcher, and people can go to his website, JLN Labs, I believe it's .org. You know, people can just Google Jean-Louis Naudin's name and go to his website, and he has all sorts of experiments that he's performed. And and the one experiment that I was intrigued with was working with these carbon rods. And he came up with something called the VSG experiment. It's the Valet Synergistic Generator. And what that is you force an impulse function into a carbon rod, and you do that by discharging a capacitor. And this, of course, is what Tesla was doing back in his days. He would charge up a capacitor and then discharge it into a, you know, his high-frequency, high-voltage coils. But in his apparatus, he would, of course, charge up this this capacitor. And I was doing something very similar to this with this experiment here. And I haven't quite finished the experiment yet, But I would consider it the next generation of this of these carbon arc experiments. And the claim on this device was by a Brazilian researcher that replicated Jean-Louis' work and observed excess energy. And I think Jean-Louis reported a 4-to-1 increase in energy. And what
so he's getting four times more energy out than he puts in.
That's correct.
That's pretty significant.
And there was another researcher that partnered with Jean-Louis in his experiment and did and he did the theoretical work. And he determined that there was a an energy exchange occurring with the vacuum, you know, what we call the active vacuum, or what Tom Bearden coined the active vacuum. And he observed, Jean-Louis observed about a 4-to-1 ratio. In other words, for every watt you put in, you get 4 watts out.
But you, see, I don't understand something, and maybe you can explain this to me, because I'm not an electrical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we hear standard status quo academia and status quo scientists talk about this kind of technology, or just the concept of it, as you said, they poo-poo it, and they do so based on several principles, but basically it all comes down to entropy. Everything runs down, not up.
Right.
However, this same status quo bunch tell us that at the base of life is energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that that is what causes life to be life. It's energy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you take a kernel of corn and you plant it in the field, and if all the conditions are correct for it to grow, it will grow. And if it only produces one ear of corn, you've got 100-to-1, basically, 100-to-1 output, because you put in one kernel, now you've got an ear that's got maybe 100 kernels on it. And so example after, I won't take the time, but example after example, all through everything that is life, you get back more than you plant, unless there is some kind of strange intervention like a drought or something like that. So why, if energy is at the base of life and that's the way life operates, why would they then not think that energy would operate the same way?
Well, if we look at the plant works by photosynthesis. So it's converting sunlight, I think, into sugars. And the plant is using that to grow. And then, of course, you have the old biblical saying there, you know, be fruitful and multiply. But it works by photosynthesis, and
it's taking sunlight and other elements and mixing them into its onboard lab. It's doing all of that, converting energy. It's doing essentially what a capacitor does. It's converting, it's building up what it needs to grow. And a capacitor, you feed it a little bit of energy, and it a little bit of current, and it starts building up. And I don't understand why, if everything is at its core energy, why there would be the idea that energy itself would only operate under entropy, where it's just running down.
You know, we're kind of taking a different approach here, and that is, let's just step back for a second here and look at this term that I call free energy.
Okay.
And personally, I don't mind doing it because I have a definition of free energy, and I'd like to tell the audience, you know, exactly what that is.
Yeah, please do.
And what free energy is, it's a vacuum exchange. And exactly what that is that if we take an experiment that was performed back in, I think it was back in the 60s, it was called the Pound-Rebka-Snyder experiment. And what they did is that they took a radioactive source that emitted photons, you know, gamma ray particles. It was a little piece of radioactive iron. And it would emit these photons at a very specific frequency. Now, what they did is that they took this emitter and they put it at the top of a tower. And then at the bottom of the tower, they put a detector. And what they found was that gravity acted on that photon. So my interpretation on that is that there's a free energy effect occurring here. And that free energy effect is a vacuum. There's a vacuum exchange occurring with the photon in space and with gravity. And the free energy effect is simply defined as energy that can be added or subtracted, you know, with this photon, with space. Now, with gravity, you know, we're given this mainstream science interpretation that, well, it's related to the curvature of space, you know, with general relativity. But I kind of look at gravity as a force, which is what Newton interpreted as. So what we see here is a photon being acted on it's being acted upon by gravity, and energy can be either added or subtracted from that photon. And so what they measured with this tower experiment in this Pound, Repka, Snydern experiment, and people can go to my website and look this up. You know, I have it in my library. And what they discovered was that the energy of the photon increased in a gravity field, so that when it emitted downward towards the planet, it increased in energy. And then when they reversed the experiment, it decreased by the same amount. Okay, they put the emitter at the bottom of the tower and the detector at the top, and they observed a reverse effect. So what I'm saying is that there's a free energy effect here, a vacuum exchange occurring with the photon that can either add or subtract energy. And that's the definition of free energy.
Okay, now...
And what that means is that, Tom Bearden pretty much pioneered this logic here, mm-hmm. that all energy comes from the vacuum. And given that effect, I'm starting to agree with them that that's absolutely true. All energy does come from this, the perturbations of space, you know, what quantum physicists call the quantum foam, the quantum vacuum. You know, it's this random fluctuations that occur in space. It's also called the ether, you know, what people call the ether.
All right, we're about 20 seconds here from a break. And I want to talk about how that relates to anti-gravity, because I know that you have been involved with anti-gravity research and experimentation, and I want us to get into that as well, and I want you to explain to us how this is connected. But we'll do that on the other side of this break. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is William Alec. He is an electrical engineer. He's been for many years doing research now in free energy and in anti-gravity. So, Bill, you mentioned earlier that when you went to this conference or seminar where Colonel Bearden was speaking.
Right.
It captivated you, and you mentioned earlier along the way that free energy and anti-gravity were sort of related. So how are they related?
Well, I've been describing this experiment. It's called the Pound-Repka-Snyder experiment.
Mm-hmm.
It was done at Harvard, and I believe it was done back in the 60s. And the listeners out there can go to my website, which is intellect.com, and go to my library section, and they can look this experiment up.
And let me interject for those who are new tonight, and this is their first time to listen to the show. On my website, if you just scroll down, you see the little piece there about tonight's show, and you see Bill's picture. Click his picture. It'll take you to that website. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. Yes. Well, what I'm trying to show is the relationship of gravity and free energy with this experiment and how gravity affects a photon as it travels from a source down to a detector and how it changes in energy. So my definition of free energy is how it's affected by gravity. You know, that's the relationship here, is that energy can be either freely given or taken from the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy can be added or subtracted to this photon, you know, that's being emitted by this radioactive iron. So the question is, exactly what is gravity? And that's the real mystery here. You know, people are trying to figure out exactly what gravity is. And with my research as of late here, I've come to a conclusion that gravity is something called what is called a torque field. And, you know, what a torque is, it's twisting motion. You know, if you take an empty can and then you twist it, it's this twisting motion. It's a torque.
Mm-hmm.
And what that is, it's a longitudinal effect. It appears to be a longitudinal effect that's related to spin of fundamental particles. And spin is the angular momentum of these fundamental particles. They have spin.
Okay.
And there appears to be some sort of a longitudinal effect with this spin, and that's what gives us gravity, which is this attraction between masses. Now, how do I know this? Well, there's a very interesting experiment I performed just a few weeks ago. It was over here in Sedona. And what turned me on to this experiment was a lecture given by David Sureda at the UFO Congress about a month ago. And I attended this conference and heard David's lecture, and he was showing this fascinating video of an interview he conducted with Boyd Bushman. And Boyd Bushman is a retired Lockheed scientist, a weapons designer, and he performed a very simple experiment some years back at Lockheed, where he took two magnets, and these two magnets had an opposing configuration, and he bolted them together, and these two magnets were two neodymiums, very powerful.
Okay, now what is a neodymium magnet?
Well, that's this material that's highly magnetic, and it was discovered back in the 70s, and it's a magnetic material that it's very powerful magnet.
Okay.
And they're quite expensive, and I had some laying around in my lab. I was doing some experiments with them a few years back. And I just had these laying around in a lab. But anyway, what Boyd Bushman did in his experiment is that he took two magnets in an opposing configuration. It could be north-north or south-south. And he bolted them together. And then what he did is that he essentially turned it into a rock. I think he either wrapped it with something or did something and just made it look like a rock. And what he did is he repeated Galileo's experiment from a couple hundred years ago. And what Galileo did is, you know, he discovered that when you drop two rocks of different mass, he did that on top of the Tower of Pisa, when he dropped these two rocks of different mass, they hit the ground at the same time. And Boyd Bushman repeated this experiment, except that he used an ordinary rock and this opposing configuration on these magnets. And then he dropped the two. And to his amazement, he discovered that the magnets in the opposing configuration fell slower. And, you know, he documented this in Tom Sarita's video, and which I thought was rather extraordinary. And so, you know, here you have an opposing field magnet falling slower. Now, they took the next step here at Lockheed and built, according to David, you know, they built a much larger version of these magnets, and instead of neodymium, he used large electromagnets and hooked it up to a nuclear power generator and powered these electromagnets in an opposing field configuration. And I guess the rest is black op history, as they say.
Did he say what happened? Did they experience anti-gravity?
Well, I would assume so. But there's more to the story here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a few years back, I did an experiment with gyroscopes. Now, gyroscopes are very interesting devices. And a researcher by the name of Lathwaite, and again, people can go to my library section, look up Lathwaite, and he did a lot of work with gyroscopes back in the 60s and 70s. And there's a nice video picture that people can view of a lecture he gave on gyroscopes. And I started pursuing an experiment with what is called gyrostatic precession. And there's this very interesting anomaly that pops up when you play with gyroscopes. And that is when the gyroscope, when you start it up. Now this gyroscope is configured in a on a balance. And it's gyroscope at one end and then a battery pack and then maybe some weights at the other end, and it's balanced. And what I did is that when I started the gyroscope up, the a very interesting anomaly occurred. And interesting enough, the one who noticed this anomaly was Richard Hoagland. I went over to Richard Hoagland's place and was showing him this device, and he noticed this peculiar anomaly that occurred. And that is, when you start the gyroscope up, the balance would tip. And it would, and depending upon how the gyroscope was balanced, if it was weighted heavy or it was weighted lighter, it would either tip up or tip down when you would start it up, which is a very intriguing anomaly. Now, that anomaly correlates to Richard's work there with Bruce De Palma. I don't know if you ever heard of Bruce De Palma.
Sure.
He was an MIT research scientist back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Hoagland, he likes to talk about this experiment of the spinning ball experiment using steel balls performed mm-hmm. by this Bruce De Palma. And what Bruce observed is that when you take a steel ball and you just throw it up and down, well, it just falls with the rate of gravity. But if you take this the ball and you spin it, I think at about 20,000 RPM, the ball goes higher and falls faster. Okay, and he documented this in some reports. People, you know, again, can Google it. And it's very interesting because, you know, we're looking at spin, you know, spin of the steel ball. You know, we're looking at the spin of gyroscopes. And we're observing that, you know, how this gyroscope is weighted, it'll either tip up or tip down, and it's analogous to the steel ball experiment. And so, you know, if we look at magnets, you know, it's, you know, again, we're looking at spin. Now, in that video, Boyd Bushman stated that that he thinks that gravity is related, you know, some cousin of magnetism. And I'm saying, no, it's not related to magnetism. It's related to spin, fundamental particles. So to me, what gravity is, it's related to spin of fundamental particles. And if we take the next step here towards anti-gravity, you know, what is this this gravitational effect? We go back to my experiment I did in Sedona, repeating Boyd Bushman's experiment with the magnet. Okay, mm-hmm. And I took Boyd Bushman's experiment a step further, and I repeated his experiment with the opposing fields on the magnets, and observed that it fell slower. And then I took the next step where the magnets are in an attractive configuration, and the magnet block dropped faster. Okay, and that's the extraordinary thing of this test. So this is telling me that gravity is related to spin, you know, of fundamental particles. Now, I suppose the whole audience out there is probably scratching their head, is like, okay, where is all this leading to? We have to wind the clock back back to World War II. And what the German Nazis were doing in all their research projects. And they had this machine called the Nazi Bell experiment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you've heard of it.
Sure.
Yeah, the Nazi Bell experiment. Well, the trouble is that nobody really knows how that machine works. I mean, it was essentially designed, built, and it actually worked, as claimed by some of the concentration camp eyewitnesses. You know, this machine actually worked. And then after the war, it disappeared. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It vanished. Now, according to Joe Farrell, and I had him on my show last week, Joe discovered that they took this bell down to Argentina, and the Nazis had purchased 10,000 square miles of property down there, and continued their development effort with this Nazi bell device. Now, this all happened after the war.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll pick up with the Nazi bell in Argentina when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More on anti-gravity on the other side of this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Bill Alec. Bill, we had to interrupt you as we went away for break, and I want us to get back into this Nazi bell. What's the deal with that? It's down in Argentina, right?
That's right. According to Joe's research, the Nazi bell disappeared down to Argentina. And according to Joe's research, there was a technology exchange that occurred at the end of the war. The Germans had developed a uranium bomb, a nuclear device, and there's evidence that they set off a test explosion back towards the end of 44. They exploded a nuclear bomb. And what the Germans found out, it was how to detonate uranium. And this is something that the Americans couldn't do. And but anyway, the Germans had discovered this. So they there was this technology exchange that occurred at the end of the war, and it appears that the top Nazi officials disappeared, you know, at the end of the war. Joe thinks that Hitler did not die in that bunker in Berlin. towards the end of the war. He escaped to Argentina.
Well, even General Eisenhower, after the war, said that he thought that was highly suspect, and that he wasn't at all convinced that Hitler was dead. However, during the war, we detonated two bombs in Japan.
Right.
So I don't understand, if we got the technology from the Nazis after the war.
No, this was before the end of the war.
Oh, okay, before the end of the war, yeah, but near the end.
Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, according to Joe, there was this technology exchange between the Americans and the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And they were given essentially this yellow cake material, you know, this uranium, this highly refined uranium material, and also the fuses to detonate them, to correctly detonate these bombs. And so the Americans acquired this technology, and we've been in a standoff ever since, you know, with the Russians, you know, with the Cold War.
Okay.
But in the meantime, these top Nazi officials escaped to Argentina and were developing this Nazi bell device.
And by the way, let me throw some corroboration in on this. We know for sure now, I mean, this is historically established now, that a great many Nazi officials were able to get new papers, new identification through various means, some through foreign embassies, some through the Vatican, and probably some through the U.S. government with Project Paperclip.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went to other places, and Argentina today has very large pieces of ground that are essentially German colonies.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's where they escaped with the Nazi bell. And the Nazi bell device had a classification higher than their nuclear bomb project. And the classification, I believe, was war decisive. So that's how this bell device was classified as. Now, according to Joe's research, he only had half the picture how this machine worked. And what he had were two counter-rotating discs. And there was this platform, this test platform in Germany, where they were testing this bell device. And Joe had mentioned that there were these high-powered, very high-powered cables running to this test platform. So the question was, you know, in my mind, is that, well, okay, I mean, we had these two counter-rotating discs that were part of the Nazi bell device, but then we had this other missing component of what was the idea behind all this high voltage? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now we start to put all the pieces together here. You know, I threw out a lot of information here, a lot of technical information. And what we want to do is recreate this Nazi bell device. And I actually have a graduate mechanical engineer doing some of the design work. And this is what we're going to present at the conference.
All right, now what is this bell device supposed to do?
It's an anti-gravity machine.
Okay.
Okay, and according to the eyewitnesses at these concentration camps, now according to Joe, what he said is that all these concentration camps were built next to this industrial weapons complex that Germany built. Okay, they were disposable slave labor camps.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they built these concentration camps next to all these weapons factories, all these top secret weapon factories.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, using expendable slave labor, they can keep it secret, you know, what they're working in. Okay?
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of these projects were the uranium bomb projects. And, of course, another project was this Nazi Bell device, you know, this anti-gravity device. And again, you know, it had this classification of war decisive, which is the highest classification of any secret project that they had going on in Germany at that time. And so the Nazi Bell was this anti-gravity machine. And this is what the Germans ran off with towards the end of World War II and developed this technology. Okay, they developed it further. And also, according to Joe's research, these guys were extremely wealthy. Okay, the spoils of war back then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had just tons of spoils of war there with a fortune in gold and jewelry and everything else. I mean, they had a fabulous wealth to do their projects with. So they were well-funded with this Nazi Bell project after the war. So what we're doing here is trying to piece together, you know, what this Nazi Bell device was. And so, you know, putting together, you know, all these experiments that I've been working on, okay, with gyrostatic precession, you know, the anomalies associated with it, okay, you put together the opposing magnets, dropping them, and then observing that the opposing fields fell slower, but the attractive fields fell faster. And then you see the same effect with the spinning ball experiment, okay, with Bruce De Palma's work. You know, and you start to put all these pieces together, and you come up with the Nazi Bell device, you know, exactly what it was. And this is what I'm going to talk about, you know, and show, you know, at the upcoming conference, you know, on Memorial Day. You know, I'm going to show what the Nazi Bell device was.
Yeah, this is the conference in Sedona that we've been talking about this week, folks. All right, now, do you think that you are realistically going to be able to recreate this Nazi Bell in a fashion where it's actually going to work?
Well, the only thing we really need to do is to demonstrate a proof of concept. Okay, that we can take this design and build it. Okay, and it only has to be a small design. You know, the actual Nazi Bell device, I think, was something like 10 or 15 feet across and maybe 10 or 15 feet high, and it was bell-shaped.
You know, mm-hmm.
The Nazi Bell was a bell-shaped machine. Well, that's what we're working on, this design. And we're going to show essentially these two major components that are required to do anti-gravity, which of course takes us to the Boyd Bushman's experiment, you know, these magnets and gyroscopes and opposing spinning disk, and you put it all together.
All right, we are just a few seconds away from our top of the hour break. And when we come back from this break, what I would like for us to get into, and then we'll open up the telephone lines, what real relationship could there be between this technology and UFOs? And we'll get into that as soon as we come back from the break. In other words, are the UFOs that we're seeing and that people are reporting, are these terrestrial that have been built with this technology, or are they extraterrestrial? I don't know if my guest has the answer to that, but we'll ask it and we'll find out right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is William Alec. Let me make this announcement very quickly. The music you hear on each Kevin Smith show is music from independent artists, only independent artists. Now, we get most of that music from GarageBand.com and Music.Podshow.com. Two great services. You can go to either one of them and just listen to your heart's content. Lots of music and all kinds of different genres of music. And it's free to listen. And a big portion of it, I mean most of it, you can download, put it right on your iPod, and just have a great time, okay? So check those out. Some of the music is sent to us directly by the artists themselves, and we invite you to do that if you are an artist and you have, you're an independent artist and you have some music that you would like to get some airplay, send it to us. All right, Bill, when we went away, I posed the question, what relationship is there between this bell and the UFO phenomena as reported these days? Is there a relationship?
Well, I think there is. I think there is. Now, we left off with the Nazi bell disappearing from Germany, and it went to Argentina, okay,
yeah,
with the top brass from Nazi Germany. Now, we advanced the clock a few years here, you know, and they're developing the bell.
Yeah.
We advanced the clock a few years to Roswell in 1947. And then if we take a look at Corso's book, you know, The Day After Roswell, mm-hmm, he gives a laundry list of technologies, okay, that came out of this Roswell crash.
Yeah.
And I was stunned when Joe Farrell, you know, researching this topic, discovered that this whole laundry list can be traced back to the end of World War II, what the Germans were working on. Okay? You know, for instance, the Germans, back in the early 40s, developed laser tech.
All right. We just lost Bill's audio. I don't know if you're still there, Bill. We've lost you. It's showing that the line is still open, but you've been cut off. So what we're going to do is disconnect and reestablish communication with Bill. We have here on the Kevin Smith Show grown quite accustomed to these kinds of interruptions. I wish that that the people involved in that believed in freedom and believed in the Constitution, but apparently they don't. All right, Bill, we just lost you. I don't know what happened, but we lost you when you said it was traced back to the end of World War II, and then you were cut off.
Yes. Yes, well, we know that the Germans ran off with the bell towards the end of World War II, down to Argentina, okay, and started developing this. I mean, they had incredible amount of wealth, they had all the technology, and they had their war decisive Nazi bell experiment, you know, which was a successful experiment in anti-gravity.
Okay.
So now we roll the clock, you know, they start developing it, technologies there, and then we come up to Roswell in 1947. And in Corso's book, you know, The Day After Roswell, Corso lists a whole list of laundry items here, you know, including, you know, he lists a whole thing of technologies that mm-hmm. are to be transferred to American industry. Okay, and these technologies include, you know, silicon wafers, you know, these semiconductor wafers. Okay, the Nazis had semiconductor wafer technology being developed during the war. They had this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had laser technology. Okay, not only lasers, but tunable gas lasers. Okay, this was during the war. You know, probably developed back in the late 30s, early 40s. You know, they had all this advanced technology, including anti-gravity, but that wasn't given, okay, by Corso.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they had this fabulous technology. And curious enough, you know, everything in Corso's laundry list can be traced back to Nazi Germany. Okay, and this in this 1947 crash at Roswell. So then the question is, what crashed at Roswell? Okay, you know, is it German Nazi anti-gravity technology? You know, did they develop? You know, is this Hanabu 1 crap? You know, for real?
You know, and what do you think about that? Do you think it was the Nazi technology, or do you think it was extraterrestrial?
I've actually been kicking that idea around now for a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and I actually talked with some people, you know, some witnesses of Roswell, and they're saying that these craft were piloted by the Greys. And they figure that, well, it's a gray craft that crashed. And I think it may have been Greys flying a German UFO craft.
Why would the Greys be flying a German UFO craft?
Because that's who they had first contact with, were the Nazis.
Okay, so you think that is continuing today? Is it still going on?
From the stories that I heard, if you take apart all the abduction stories, you know, they generally involve these Greys and military government types.
Okay.
Okay. So, I mean, just putting two and two together here, it seems to me that the Greys are in line with the governments. There's some sort of technology exchange, or using the technology, this anti-gravity. And what crashed at Roswell was a German built UFO piloted by these Greys.
Why would the Greys not be flying their own stuff?
Well, maybe they are. I don't know. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I can't really tell you.
Yeah, you're just saying that it's a possibility that it was German technology. So you're not saying that it is German technology. You're saying that it is a possibility.
Yes, I think it's a very strong possibility.
All right. Fair enough. All right. Let's open up the telephone line. And our audience is invited now to give us a call. The telephone number, 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. Now, if you have to pay long distance charges to call that number, use our toll-free number. It is 888-223-4599. 888-223-4599. If you live outside of the United States, you live outside of Canada, and you don't want to pay that international long distance toll, the numbers will work, by the way, from anywhere in the world. You can call us. And we do, from time to time, get calls from around the world and always enjoy them. But if you don't want to make that international long-distance call, you can go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. And all you have to do is just scroll down. You'll see under Bill's picture, you will see a link. It's in green. It's a green link. And it says flash message. So you can click that and send me a flash message, and I'll be glad to read it and get Bill to comment on it. All right, 602-539-9580 or 888-223-4599. Bill, based on your research, your experiments, you say you are now in the process of gearing up to build one of these Bell devices, this anti-gravity device. How long before we see successful anti-gravity flights of something? How long do you think it will be?
Well, Well, I think once the experiment is replicated, you know, and we get a proof of concept, and that is we only have to see a little bit of weight loss, then I think we can proceed very rapidly, you know, scaling this machine up.
Do you think...
Once we demonstrate, you know, a weight loss, then we can proceed to, you know, the next step here.
All right, do you think that, because, you know, you've talked about the... That you think it's very likely the Nazis continued their experimentation, research, and development, it would be reasonable then to assume that after all this time, they have achieved some degree of proficiency with this. Do you think that it's possible that other governments of the world have done the same thing and may have anti-gravity flight capability?
Well, if they do, I think it's maybe the U.S. came in and took it. I mean, you hear about these crash retrieval sites, mm-hmm. and they seem to be cleaned up very quickly. And I wouldn't be surprised if the U.S. military would come into some other country and, you know, take their, you know, crash saucers. But you hear that, you know, these crashes occur all over the world.
All right, so if they're retrieving, what are you saying, they're retrieving crashed Nazi craft?
Well, I would say early on. Now, since then, you know, if we wind the clock forward here, if we look at this this Boyd Bushman experiment, they moved very rapidly to a nuclear-powered device using opposing electric and magnetic fields. You know, they moved very rapidly, you know, into you know, these machines, you know, anti-gravity machines.
Okay, so what would that mean in terms of our capabilities? I mean, do you think we have anti-gravity flight?
I think we do. And it was admitted by Ben Rich, you know, the president and CEO of Lockheed Skunk Works, you know, some years ago made the statement that we can take E.T. home. So, you know, Lockheed... you know, has this technology, and Ben Rich said it would take an act of God, okay, to release this technology from the black op world, you know, into the public sector.
Uh-huh.
And,
all right, so now here you are. You're the public sector, and you've done this research and these experiments, and you're planning to... build and successfully test this technology. Do you have any security concerns for yourself?
Well, you know, that takes me back to the year 1977, you know, when I had this this vision. You know, I was shown a vision of my future back mm-hmm. then. And in this vision, you know, I'm working on this craft. Now, there's something that very interesting that happens in this vision, and that is where I'm building this or working on this machine. It's what I saw was, you know, I'm working on this in a hangar.
All right.
In almost like a garage, you know, okay. Working on this disc. And then I find myself standing outside, you know, part of this dream, and I see running across the desert... almost like a paramilitary force, you know, assassination squad, sent in to essentially do me away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is all part of this vision, and it's to stop this craft from taking off. And they were sent in on this mission to essentially dispose of me. Well, in this vision, they do not succeed at all,
mm-hmm.
and And at that point, the vision ends.
So, if the vision comes true, you'll succeed.
The suppression is active.
Mm-hmm.
It's active, and they do not want this technology in the public sector at all. You know, they want to keep it hidden in the black world.
We'll talk about why in just a moment. Let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Rex from Miami.
Hi, Rex.
Hey, Bill, I was wondering, have you run across any working devices for free energy or over unity that would be sufficient for an average house, like, say, 5 kilowatts or so?
Well, I have heard some devices out there, and, just some of the experiments that I worked on, with over-unity and free energy.
William, we're going to have to ask you to speak up. I'm doing everything I can to bring you up, and you're so quiet I can barely hear you.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay. Well, the devices that I've worked on, were these carbon arc experiments. And there's also another gentleman that is working at Stephen Greer's area there. You've probably heard of Stephen Greer's projects.
Mm-hmm.
And there's apparently a free energy device that he's working with. He's also working with the Stanley Myers experiments.
And you're fading away again into the sunset.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, if you speak directly into your phone and speak up, we can hear you. If I turn it up anymore, we get feedback.
Okay. Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Just from the experiments that I worked on with carbon arcs, I observed this excess energy. And I left off with the Jean-Louis VSG experiment, which is the next level up from this, is where you pulse carbon with impulse functions, discharging a capacitor into a carbon rod. You see this excess energy effect.
But have you run into any technology that is deployable to be used by homeowners yet?
Nothing that's commercially available. Everything is, in the experimental phase.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess Rex left us. Are you still with me?
Okay, yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, okay. I didn't cut Rex off, but I guess he left us.
It's very difficult trying to get funding in this field, too. The experiments are there.
Mm-hmm.
There was an interesting experiment reported just lately here by the Naval Research Labs about low-energy nuclear fusion.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that's quite promising. But the trouble is trying to get funding for this work.
What about from private investors? That's pretty difficult as well, isn't it?
This fear factor that I've run into.
Mm-hmm. What are they afraid of?
The cartels.
Mm-hmm.
The energy cartels.
I see.
That we are to use oil, this is all part of this suppression that's going on.
Well,
and it's just difficult trying to get funding for these projects.
The old paradigm, and oil is part of it, is in its death throes. Whether they like it or don't like it, there's nothing they can do to change that. It's in its death throes. And there are technologies beginning to come out that are the beginning of the end for oil, big oil. I read today, and you may have read this yourself, about the Tesla car company. Has a new model that's coming out. It's all electric. It's not hybrid. It's all electric, 100% electric. New model that's coming out next year. It's in development now. They are able to go 300 miles on $5 of electricity, and you can charge it up in 45 minutes. So, you go 300 miles, you pull in to get a hamburger, plug in, charge up, and then go on your way. and it goes from 0 to 60 in a little under 4 seconds, faster than a Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and
I
it's...
I understand what they're using is just very efficient battery technology.
Maybe, but it's not oil. Not oil. And that's the point. The beginning of the end is upon the oil industry.
In a way, yeah, they're still using oil because when you plug into a wall socket, where's the energy coming from that supplies power to your house? It's
generally it can come from all different kinds of places. You know, you don't have to use oil to generate that electricity either.
Well, it may not be oil, but it's probably coal.
You don't even have to use that. There will be a switch over to solar. There will be a switch over to wind. There will be a switch over, I'm pretty sure, to cold fusion as that comes online. And the beginning, I'm not saying the end is here. I'm saying it's the beginning of the end. And you know, they can see that. Let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're first up. Hang on just a second. My telephone system is doing weird stuff to me here. All right. Now here we go. Caller, you're first up, and then we have another caller, and you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Debbie from Columbus.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I just wanted to ask Bill a question. I'm familiar with what he's talking about in the terms of quantum physics. But what I wanted to know was, has Bill been able to do any experiments, number one? And number two, could there be any outside problems that might affect this anti-gravity, such as Earth's gravitational field or electromagnetic energy or anything like that? And I'll take my question off the air.
Okay, thank you. And we've got about a minute here until break, Bill.
Mm-hmm. Well, the experiment that I performed over here, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, it was a replication of the Boyd-Bushman experiment. Well, I just dropped a magnet with an opposing field configuration, and those are two neodymium magnets that I glued together, and then I wrapped it up in electrical tape so it looks like a rock. And then I just took an ordinary rock and just dropped the two. And I observed that the opposing field magnets, it fell slower by about, I would say about a half a foot. And I videotaped this. And I'll be showing this videotape at the upcoming conference. And then I took Boyd Bushman's experiment one step further and used two magnets in an attractive configuration and wrapped that up to look like a rock. And then I just dropped that with the ordinary rock. And I observed that the attractive magnets, neodymium magnets, it fell faster. Okay, and I videotaped it. So I have videotape evidence that I'll be showing here, showing this fascinating experiment with magnets. So there's this relationship that Boyd thinks that there's some cousin of magnetism that's related to gravity.
All right, we're into a break, and we'll be back on the other side of this break. The caller that's on hold, if you'll stay on hold, I'll take you first up whenever we come back. Don't go away, folks. Let's go to the telephone line and see if our caller is still with us. Caller, are you with me?
Yes, good evening, Kevin. This is Kevin from Northern Alberta calling.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you this evening?
Outstanding.
I'm right on. I wanted to ask your guest, has anybody replicated the bell?
Not that I know of. You know, it's been a mystery all these years. They have half of the solution. And half of the solution are these counter-rotating discs. And what counter-rotation does is that it cancels out angular momentum, okay, of your spinning object. And when you have these counter-rotating discs spinning, your gyroscope in this case just falls over. Okay?
Okay.
Now, in the experiments that I've done with gyroscopes, is that when they're spinning, there's this anomaly that pops up. And this anomaly is correlated, I think, to Bruce De Palma's work of a spinning steel ball. That when you launch a spinning ball, okay, it will go higher and fall faster. Okay, and when it falls faster than the normal speed of gravity. And this is what Bruce De Palma observed. And I observed the same effect in gyroscopes. And then with the bell, what we're essentially doing is canceling out this angular momentum. And I think, you know, according to my research, that gravity is related to spin of fundamental particles. You know, it's a longitudinal effect of spin. And when we have this counter rotation, we have a cancellation of the spin component. Okay, which is an essential element of the bell, but there's this missing component of, well, what's behind this high voltage? You know, what's the configuration of the high voltage? And simply put, it's to generate an opposing magnetic field, okay, between your two spinning discs. And this is the whole key behind the Nazi bell device. You have two components, counter-rotating disc and opposing magnetic fields. And both can be traced back to these gravitational, the anomalies observed in gyroscopes and in my opposing magnet experiment of Boyd Bushman.
Okay.
And
what
so
did
that
you
is the Nazi bell device.
Now, Hello? Did they ever discover?
Okay. Let me say to Kevin, if you'll just hang on just a minute, Kevin, I'll be back with you. And to the caller who is now on hold, hang on, I'll be with you. Kevin, you're back with us now. Now, he went away. Okay. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Chris from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Kevin. I wanted to ask your guest if he had any familiarity with the work of Mr. Hutchins there in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I've been tracking John Hutchison's work for quite some time. I'm pretty good friends with him, too. His experiments deals with high voltages, you know, static fields, you know, high voltage static fields. And I know he's used those fields in certain configurations, and he can demonstrate levitation, okay, with his equipment. And I know today he can demonstrate for people, you know, anti-gravity, you know, using his technology.
Yeah, Bill, you're going to have to stop whispering, man. You're going to have to speak into your phone. We're barely getting audio from you.
Okay.
Can
you hear me?
Yeah, we can now. John Hutchinson has been on this show several times, and he has truly some amazing videos of experiments that he's done. And one of them involves a cannonball that he causes to rise up off of the ground using, electromagnetic fields of some type. Have you seen that experiment, William?
Yes, I have. I saw the levitating cannonball. It was a 90-pound cannonball.
Mm-hmm. I asked John if he was aware of the fact that the thing that makes a cannonball work is not just that you fire a big ball of iron. It's full of gunpowder. And when it hits, it explodes. And he said, no. I said, you might want to check that out before you start loading it up with electricity again. So,
well, as far as I know, it didn't go boom at all.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks for the call. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the telephone number is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. 9580 or the toll-free number 1-888-223-4599. Or you can send me a flash message. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can use our flash message feature. So that means if you're one of our listeners in Australia or in the UK or France or Germany or wherever, but you're not in the USA or Canada, send me a flash message and I'll read it on the air. So far as you know, then no one has actually duplicated the bell, except perhaps, as you mentioned earlier, the Nazis may have escaped with it to Argentina to do further research and development, and may have developed it into something quite usable now.
Right.
Now, I think this was done, I could be wrong, but I think that initial experiment with the bell was done at Pentamundi. Is that correct? In Germany? Actually, it's not in Germany. It's in what used to be called Czechoslovakia, I think.
You know, I'm not really sure where that research took place. Joe Farrell would have the answer to that.
Why do you think the Nazis didn't? I mean, it was classified higher than their nuclear program,
right?
But then they didn't seem to really get behind this and really go for it. Why do you think that happened?
Well, actually, I think they did. I mean, they knew that they were going to lose the war, back in 44.
Okay.
44-45 time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew where they were going to lose the war, so there was this technology exchange that took place. And the technology exchange had to do with their nuclear bomb project. You know, they had the ability to purify their uranium stockpiles and produce this yellow cake material.
Mm-hmm.
And they used these high speed centrifuges, which of course I think led to the development of the Bell project. There was some artifact of that related to the Bell project, and this laser technology. And there was this technology exchange that took place with the Americans and the Russians on both sides, which then produced the Cold War for like the next 40, 50 years. And so they essentially had the U.S. and Russia in a this Cold War standoff position, which would allow them to continue with the Nazi Bell development down in Argentina.
So you're saying they were playing us off of each other?
Yes. In a standoff.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about now? Because, I mean, allegedly the Cold War is over. So what about now?
Well, now we have this, this Boyd Bushman. And Lockheed apparently has anti-gravity technology, and it's hidden away in the black op world.
Uh-huh.
And so that's been developed. And so I think a number of these sightings that we see today is this black op technology.
So then what would you say about the UFOs and extraterrestrials? And let me explain what happens a lot of times. I have said that I think many of the things that people are reporting, the UFOs that are being reported, are probably highly advanced terrestrial technology. In other words, we built it, it's our stuff, and it's probably our guys flying it. All right, now, that being said, then a lot of times I get this in emails, then people say that I'm saying there are no ETs, there are no UFOs, and that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that a lot of what we see is us.
Right.
And the point being that I think that extraterrestrials and UFOs, that's a whole different subject now, although they probably are the origins of this technology. But do you think that there are extraterrestrial craft that fly our skies?
Yes, I do. Now, the question is the line between ET and our technology.
Yeah.
You know, that's where things get kind of fuzzy. And I think it's meant to be that way. You know, I think there's an agenda behind this this black op, flying their technology around, and the ETs, you know, the real ETs that are out there. And I think it's meant to look this way. You know, if you look at what Von Braun said to Carol Rosen, you know, as this last... this last straw that is going to be, perpetrated here on the world is going to be this false flag alien invasion scenario. I mean, Von Braun said that himself to Carol Rosen.
On March the 22nd, which of course is, 4 days ago, there was a report from Texas and... The report was that it was a UFO sighting. The witness saw it land. It was he and his wife together. They were driving. It was a rural area. They saw it land in a field. They saw three individuals get out of this UFO and walk away from it. And then a few seconds later, the thing powered up and took off and left them, left the three guys. Now, the witness was driving down the road when they observed this happening, and he wanted to make a U-turn and go back, and he did. And by the time he got back there, he had lost sight of where these three guys were. He didn't see them anymore. But they weren't on it when it took off. With something like that, would you suspect that's us, or would you suspect that is... extraterrestrial? I mean, just off the top of your head, and I know you're speculating, but what does that sound like to you?
Well, it sounds to me like there's an agenda taking place here. You know, it's meant to look that way.
Okay. We have to take this break, and when we come back from this break, we'll continue. We'll have time for one or two more calls, and get your fingers ready to do the dialing. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach, and of course that means we only have a few minutes left. If you've been wanting to call and ask a question about anti-gravity, here's a guy that works with it, with the research and experimentation, and is about to try and build this a working model of this Nazi bell. And if you got a question, or if you have a comment, you need to give us a call at 602-539-9580 or at 888-223-4599. If you're outside the USA, you're outside of Canada, you can send me a flash message. Go to my website and scroll down to the link. It's green. It says flash message. Click that, and you can send a flash message to us. All right, Bill. There's been a lot of talk about, because of the Von Braun statement to his assistant, there's been a lot of speculation that there's going to be a false flag.
Right.
And they're going to say, oh, it's an invasion from extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds pretty cool. I mean, it sounds like a real good idea for, you know, somebody that's got some nefarious plans for us. But that would imply then that they have the ability to impersonate UFOs.
Right.
So if we're on the cusp of that, that means that they've really got some stuff that's way ahead of the curve in terms of what we know.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go to the phone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Rick from Kentucky.
Hi, Rick.
Hello, Bill. I find it really interesting. I've got a degree in electronics and... when I graduated was around 1971, and there was just a sudden leap from vacuum tube circuitry to solid state circuitry that pretty much seemed like it happened overnight. We got that technology from somebody. I don't know who. I think you've answered that question fairly well tonight, though. But I've always had that in my mind that leap was just too big. And too fast.
Yeah, the Germans had silicon wafer or semiconductor technology. Yeah, that's one of the things that Joe Farrell was showing. He was showing a slide of wafers of that the Germans Nazis developed back in the 40s. So, I mean, I was
amazed.
Well,
they say everything's 30 years ahead of what we have. So I guess that's true.
But now, where did the Nazis get it?
Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question.
You know, the stories are, the rumors are, that the Nazis were sort of in league with and had contact with extraterrestrials.
Yes.
Now,
I think that's true.
Well, you know, I was going to say that sort of story, it sort of exists in the realm of rumor and mythology, but it's beginning to appear that maybe it's not rumor and mythology. I mean, if the Nazis had this technology, they got it somewhere.
Yeah, I think so too, Kevin.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you,
right.
Kevin.
Mm-hmm. All righty then. That will be our final call for the evening. And if you had a question or you had a comment and your heart was palpitating and you're breaking out in a cold sweat because you just didn't know whether you could call a radio show, you see, I didn't bite anyone all the way through. And so maybe next time you'll give us a call. I hope so. Bill... We've only got these few minutes left. Let's talk about the conferences coming up. You're going to be appearing at this conference. What are you going to be talking about?
Yes. My lecture title is going to be Out of the Gravity Well. And I'll be showing this video of this experiment along with more of my research. So it's going to be a PowerPoint presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go into some detail, on some of these fascinating experiments I've been doing.
Yeah.
And we'll show a design of the Nazi bell device, how we think it really works. And we're going to attempt to try and replicate a small model of it and see if it will lose its weight.
How much weight does it need to lose, really, for you to be able to detect it?
Well, it would be the weight of the device. If it loses, just a few pounds, that would be a proof of concept that, the experimental, that the experiment, the theory behind it is correct.
Okay, now what is it constructed of?
The Nazi bell device, if we look at what kind of technology they had, back in the 30s and 40s. I mean, you're looking at coils, copper magnet wire coils,
Yeah, but the bell itself, is it iron? Is it aluminum? Is it titanium? What is it?
Well, it's most likely was made out of iron. You know, they had some aluminum back then. You know, it you know, they didn't have the exotic materials we have today.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to build it, I think they used iron, steel, copper wire.
Now the story about the
technology to drive it, and then gear sets, to get the counter rotation, and then commutators, to transfer the electricity, to the coils.
Well, the story about their successful experiment says that the thing took off and flew up to the ceiling.
Right. Well, that's what was reported.
Yeah.
Is the levitation.
So, I mean, even with iron, steel, heavy stuff.
Yeah, tons.
Yeah.
And yet it levitated and, took off.
Are there commercial applications that could be done with this technology easily?
Well, just watch the Jetsons. The cartoon series, The Jetsons. And, there's your applications.
So then, if this can be done, then it would be possible for us to replace our automobiles that have tires on them with flying craft.
It changed the world. This technology, it was classified war decisive. It's world-changing technology.
Mm-hmm.
And, anti-gravity is going to change the world. I mean, we're no longer confined to the Earth. It's true freedom. That's what we're looking at here. To come and go from the planet as we choose.
Okay, now if we did that...
Slaves to the empire, so to speak.
Well, that means we could just run over to the moon for a Saturday afternoon little picnic, then.
That's correct. But why stop there?
I probably would.
Rich admitted that we have technology to take E.T. home.
Yeah, he did.
He's light years away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, listen, it's been fascinating, and I want to thank you for being with us this evening. We're just about out of time, and... I want to thank you for being with me, and if you will, just stay on the line with me as I close the show. I'd like to talk with you for a moment after the show. All right, folks, that's a wrap. That's it. Anti-gravity, you just heard from someone who's actually involved in the research and development, and I hope, found it interesting and enlightening, as I did. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.